Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. For 2 hours today, behind rain-spattered windscreens, a convoy of white police vehicles wound steadily northwards through Israel. Their journey had begun at the crossing point from the south of the Gaza Strip. That was where Hamas had handed over to the Red Cross, who then handed on to the Israelis, four coffins. It's believed that the bodies are of four hostages who were abducted from the kibbutz in southern Israel where they'd lived until the 7th of October 2023. The four are thought to be 32-year-old Shiri Bibas, her two children, 4-year-old Ariel and 9-month-old Kfir, along with the 84-year-old peace activist Oded Lifshitz. In fact, just as we were coming on air, it was reported that the Lifshitz family have now had confirmation that his remains are in one of the coffins. The return of the bodies is the next phase of the current ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. Let's speak first to the BBC's Mark Lowen, who joins us from Jerusalem. Mark, a different type of hostage exchange today. Give me your assessment of how it's all being received in Israel.
A different type, Tim, but still the same stage-managed affair by Hamas. Just yesterday, the Red Cross was calling on Hamas and Islamic Jihad, the other group holding hostages in Gaza, not to let this handover of coffins be done in a public, stage-managed way, but to try to preserve some dignity for the dead. But that was not the case. There was a stage that was erected in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza where the four coffins were put on the stage. There was a huge poster depicting Benjamin Netanyahu as a vampire with blood coming out of his mouth and photos of the four people who Hamas said are in those coffins underneath. As the coffins were taken by the Red Cross into their vehicles, the Red Cross tried to erect screens to shield them from the glare of Hamas cameras. But, you know, Hamas fighters, heavily armed and their faces covered, surrounded them and kind of walked between the coffins, and there were photos of all the four on the coffins. So all of that will have just deepened the sense of agony here. And that agony is very, very intense. I mean, I was just looking at the newspapers here, and on front pages are just the photos of particularly those two little boys, Ariel and Kfir, just the youngest of all the hostages taken on the 7th of October, with their red hair. They've become really iconic symbols of the brutality of that day. And across this country, there are painted murals on walls of the Bibas family, and that's really become a kind of rallying cry for those calling for the release of the hostages. And the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, said that the heart of this nation has been ripped open today.
Mark Lowen, joining us live from Jerusalem. Thank you very much. Well, Adam Rose is a human rights lawyer who's been representing families of the hostages with British links. Among the people he's been helping has been Sharon Lifshitz, the daughter of 84-year-old Oded, who, as we've been hearing, is now, well, it's just now been confirmed, he is one of the bodies returned to Israel. Adam Rose spoke to me a short while ago.
Absolutely, totally bleak news. Not entirely unexpected as time has gone on. He was an 84-year-old man who we know was shot in the process of being taken hostage on the 7th of October. But yeah, the news, if it is finally confirmed, once the forensics have been undertaken, that it is him, and every indication would suggest it is him, is terribly grim. He was a remarkable man by all accounts, a peacemaker, a founder of the kibbutz, the little village on which he lived and from which he was taken. And it's just awful. Yeah, it is, as we've been saying, it is what failure looks like when somebody is taken hostage and doesn't return alive.
Mm. And over the last 60 months, we've heard here on NewsHour, I mean, I've spoken a number of times to family members who have described what a remarkable man he was, and a man who devoted himself to the cause of peace down in southern Israel.
Absolutely. Everything I know about him, again, from talking to his family, is exactly that. This was a man who was trying to work out how to personify coexistence and peacemaking And yet, in the end, he was taken hostage and was killed.
Perhaps it's a question for another day, but I'm sure it is one that the family will be asking, which is exactly when he did die. I mean, you mentioned that he was shot in the course of the abduction. Maybe it is too early to ask whether you have any details on that, or whether you think there is a chance that the family will get to find out, you know, when Oded did die.
Yes, I don't know if they'll get a chance to find out exactly when he died, but I would be fairly confident that the circumstances of his death will be found out as part of the post-mortem process.
You describe this as a failure. I mean, I'm sure that you and the family would say that the people who shot him and took him into captivity are the first people to be blamed. But how far do you think the failure spreads?
There's absolutely no question that the only people responsible for Oded Lifshitz's death are the people who took him in his 80s as a hostage and kept him for 503 days before returning his body. The failure that we talk about is the failure of the world, the civilized world, to deal with this unbelievably large hostage-taking situation, to ensure that hostages came out, as we have always argued, immediately and unconditionally. This is not a situation where those who are taken hostage need to be traded for anything. They needed to come out, and those still being held, the 69 who are still being held, need to come out ideally alive, but we know that many of those still being held are dead, and every day that carries on is a failure of international diplomacy, a failure of the world to make it absolutely clear beyond any discussion whatsoever that taking hostage is unacceptable, it is a war crime, and cannot be negotiated in exchange for anything. The other hostages' bodies who were freed today included those of two very small children. The idea that you take a one-year-old and an 80-something-year-old as hostages is entirely unacceptable.
If it has been a failure internationally, I mean, what do you think, for example, you're a British lawyer and you've been trying to exert pressure on the British government to do more about those dual national hostages. But I guess the question is what the British government could do to try and exert more pressure, or where you think it's been falling down.
I guess there are two ways of answering that question. One is that very question, in perhaps even those exact words, were put to the families by the Prime Minister when we met in Downing Street a few months ago. And the answer by one of the family members was, I'm not the world leader, I'm not the politician, it's not my job to come up with solutions in the world of diplomacy, you need to. And I think what we have felt throughout all of this is governments around the world shying away from very clear positions, making it abundantly clear to those supporting the Hamas position on this that this is entirely unacceptable and just removes those people from the world stage. That's really been one of the positions. The second thing that is quite clear is that governments just don't take sufficient responsibility. They take some responsibility for people for whom they claim to take responsibility, to leave no stone unturned. But actually, when it comes down to it, it's very hard to see on a day-to-day basis what they're really doing. They raise the cases. They undoubtedly argue the cause with, in this instance, the Qataris, the Egyptians, the Israelis, the Turks, the Americans. But they don't actually get the hostages freed. They don't sit down opposite the very people they expect Israel to sit down and negotiate with and reach a ceasefire agreement and obtain freedom for the hostages. So we're always grateful for the fact that the British government does a lot more than lots of governments have done for hostages. But inevitably, they've not done enough. And the result of not doing that is the failure that we see today of Oded Lifshitz's body coming out 503 days after he was taken in alive into Gaza.
Adam Rose, a human rights lawyer representing the family of the 84-year-old Israeli hostage Oded Lifshitz, whose body has been returned by Hamas to Israel today. Just over an hour ago, the former head of the Spanish Football Federation, Luis Rubiales, was found guilty of kissing a player without her consent. Spain's captain, Jenny Hermoso, and her teammates were being handed medals after their World Cup win in 2023 when Rubiales grabbed her head and kissed her. He'll have to pay a fine of more than $10,000. He was cleared of coercion for allegedly trying to convince Yenia Mosul to downplay the forced kiss afterwards. The BBC's Guy Hedgeco has been covering the case for us from Madrid. Guy, what more do we or have we learned about this judgment?
Well, Tim, we know that, as you say there, Luis Rubiales was found guilty of sexual assault, as well as the fine that he has to pay. He's been told he has to keep away from Jenny Hermoso a distance of 200 metres for the next year, and he can't contact her. And, of course, he was absolved of that charge of coercion. That coercion charge was an allegation made that he had tried to force Jenny Hermoso soon after he kissed her to come out in public and say that it had been a consensual kiss. So he and three others were cleared of that charge. But in his ruling, the judge said that Mr. Rubiales, after that World Cup final, had grabbed the player with both hands by the head in a surprising and with a non-consensual way, and without the acceptance of the player, he gave her a kiss on the lips. And he also said that kissing a woman on the mouth like that has a clear sexual connotation. So that seemed to be at the heart of this ruling and his decision to declare Mr. Rubiales guilty of sexual assault.
How has this case, I mean, it was a huge scandal when it all first erupted, and Rubiales himself was whatever the opposite of contrite is initially in his attempts to sort of downplay it and was very, very publicly angry about all this. But how do you think it has been viewed in the country and indeed how this judgment is likely to be viewed?
Well, I think at the time it really did dominate conversation in Spain. There was a social backlash to it. People demanding Mr. Rubiales' resignation. There was a political backlash to it as well. And you know, now we've had the legal fallout of all of this. So it's been a sort of a controversy which has had various dimensions to it. I think the feeling among many people was that it was likely that he was going to be found guilty of sexual assault. And I think that's in part because of the sort of the social context to all of this and the fact that sexual consent and gender equality have been such fiercely debated issues in Spain over recent years. So I think a lot of people are expecting, whatever happened, that there to be some kind of decision that saying that Mr. Rubiales was guilty of sexual assault. I think there's a feeling that this is likely to be the end of the matter, although we will possibly see appeals. In fact, we know we're going to see an appeal from Mr. Rubiales himself. He said he's going to appeal this decision.
Guy Hedgeco in Madrid, thank you very much. You're listening to NewsHour. It's live from the BBC. Coming up on the programme, Myanmar has begun sending back hundreds of Chinese nationals who've been working in internet scam centres. But how did they end up in Myanmar?
There is a skill to being a good scammer, and they need people with language skills, which is why you will find people who've been lured there from, for example, Africa. And of course, lots of Chinese, because China is a great market for the scammers to go for. They can't always get people voluntarily, and they do lure them there and then hold them, often in very, very rough circumstances.
That's coming up in about 30 minutes, that story. Main headline this has, we've been hearing, a convoy carrying the coffins of four Israeli hostages who've been held by Hamas in Gaza has reached Tel Aviv for formal identification of the bodies. You're with the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, live from London, with me, Tim Franks. Yemen is a war-ravaged and immensely poor country where tens of millions, in fact the UN reckons 35 million people, are utterly reliant on aid. So there's considerable concern about the decision by the United Nations to pause operations in some areas. That, in turn, has been a reaction to the Iran-backed Houthi rebel group arresting aid workers. It's a story which our Middle East correspondent Sally Nabil has been investigating out of our Cairo bureau.
It's a very grim picture we got from Yemen while working on this story. A lot of aid organizations, including the UN, are now scaling back their distribution process because they are scared. A lot of staff have been arrested by the Houthi rebels over the past few months. Their location is still unknown. Even their lawyers cannot talk to them. And we are talking here about dozens of people, including 24 UN employees, and the latest round of arrests was last January. It's pretty horrific, actually, that people are no longer free to work the way they like because they don't feel safe enough to operate. While we were working on the story, I've contacted many aid workers for local and international NGOs. Many of them were reluctant to speak to us, and the only person who accepted to talk to us was on condition of anonymity. So we spoke to Hana, it's not her real name, and she told us how she decided to flee the capital Sana'a, which is under Houthi control.
I walked into the office and saw my manager sitting in the meeting room, his phone and laptop confiscated and surrounded by security personnel. Outside, two armored vehicles were parked near our building and a group of masked armed men stood nearby. It's a scene I hate to remember.
The words of one of the aid workers that you've been able to speak to, Sally. Are the aid workers clear why the Houthis have gone after them in this way?
I've asked that to a lot of aid workers who I spoke to. They told me that they believe that this campaign against NGOs is meant to spread fear among the public. The Houthis are kind of making an example of these people. They accuse them of espionage. They describe them as traitors, people who work for foreign powers against their own country, so they deserve to go behind bars. So they are kind of making an example of them to intimidate the rest of the people.
This comes on top, or at the same time, as you've got this funding freeze out of the United States that the Trump administration has imposed on many projects from USAID. Given how reliant so many people in Yemen are on humanitarian operations, what are you able to assess what sort of an impact that is having?
It's a huge impact. This is where the real dilemma lies for a number of reasons. First of all, the Trump administration has redesignated the Houthis as a terrorist organization. And that is feared to further antagonize the Houthis against all of those who work in U.S.-funded NGOs. And we have to bear in mind that the United States is one of the biggest donors for Yemen. Secondly, we are in a country here, we are talking about nearly half the population are highly dependent on aid. We've talked to people in camps, displaced camps, and they told us that this lifeline is all what we've got. I mean, if it is cut, we cannot survive. We spoke to a lady whose name has been changed as well. I named her Amal. She is a mother of 9 children.
If they cut aid, they are killing us. It's like a death sentence. We cannot do anything if aid is cut. These supplies are all what we have got. If assistance is to be stopped, me and my children will die. It's painful and shameful to go begging, but this is my destiny. Shall I leave my children to die?
A woman we're calling Amal, a mother of 9, in a displaced persons camp, and she was ending that that report, that interview that I did with the BBC's Middle East correspondent, Sally Nabil. Now, a wonderful bit of how to use old technology, properly ancient technology, in a new way at scale and to do so to help mitigate climate change. Researchers in Chile say they've come up with a way of capturing large amounts of water from fog after studying the traditional methods used in the desert city of Alto Hospicio. Residents hang a fine mesh between poles to capture drinking water from the low clouds which sweep in from the Pacific Ocean. Francisco Albornoz is assistant professor at the Agricultural Engineering Department at the Catholic University of Chile and was one of the researchers on this project. Professor Albornoz, it's lovely to speak to you here on NewsAd. Just tell me, you've spotted this technology. What makes you think it can work at scale?
Hi, team. Thanks for the contact and invitation. Well, there is a huge amount of water in the fog. And in Chile, we have a special condition where the mountain range is facing the seashore. So we have about 1,000 kilometers where we can collect large amounts of water from the fog because we have these special conditions, but it's also replicable in other places of the world, like in Morocco or Spain.
And does it literally happen that the water is somehow, I mean, it's caught in this mesh, but is then somehow wrung out into buckets? I mean, how does the process work?
How does it work? Well, basically, the mesh is facing the fog. So the fog is pushed through the mesh propelled by the wind. And with that, we are just passively collecting water. And we have the possibility to collect 100 liters, about 100 liters per fog collector per day.
Right. So it drips into a trough and you collect it that way. And I mean,
exactly. And it doesn't use energy at all.
Right. No, that's a very good point. And is this water for irrigation or is this drinking water?
Actually, the quality of the water is so good that we can use it for drinking, for agriculture or any other purpose that you can imagine.
Gosh, I mean, presumably it sounds simple, the idea. Is it also relatively cheap?
Absolutely. Yeah, in comparison to a desalinating plant for seawater desalination, this is much, much cheaper. It doesn't require energy. So here we're talking about $2,000 per a fog collector. And the maintenance of this is relatively simple. You have to clean the mesh once in a while, or suddenly you will have to replace it every 2 to 5 years. So with a cost about $50, $100. So it's pretty cheap.
Are you going so far as to say that those places in the world which are, especially because of climate change, are facing increasingly dry conditions, but nonetheless are in some cases fog bound, that they really can substitute the water shortages that they are currently facing?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, we were visiting a large project in Morocco last year as a research group. So they have they are providing drinking water for about 20 to 30 villages. So they just rely on fog water collection, and they are coupling their collection of water with storage strategies, because they don't have fog throughout the year. They have fog around 100, 150 days per year.
Right. Francisco.
So it is possible, yes.
Well, it sounds wonderful, lovely to have a bit of good news to spread. But thank you very much for sharing that discovery with us. Francisco Albornoz, Assistant Professor from the Catholic University of Chile. Welcome back to NewsHour. It can be difficult sometimes for us to wrap our heads around the potential power of artificial intelligence, but the latest news from Google and scientists at Imperial College London gives us a decent metric today. Google has built an AI lab assistant which decoded a mystery over antimicrobial resistance in 2 days. Compare that to the 10 years it had previously taken scientists using the same data set to make the same progress. Professor Jose Penades is chair in microbiology at Imperial College London and co-leader of the study and early user of this technology.
We in the lab work trying to understand how bacteria swap genetic information. And we work a lot with a family of viruses that we call satellites, because they use other viruses to move. So these satellites are released, but they don't have tails. So depending on the tail you have, you can open a door or you can open another door. So what these satellites do is they have the ability to take different tails from different viruses, and depending on the tail they take, can go to one species or go to another species. So that was the main discovery, and that's important because the genes can be moved between bacterial species, which is pretty important in terms of bacterial evolution.
So the key thing about this experiment that's been conducted is that this artificial intelligence tool came up with the the answer with the same set of information, but it did so not over a course of years, but over a couple of days. When did you get the news?
It's correct that the Google system, the co-scientists provide as the top hypothesis, the hypothesis that it's right.
What was your reaction?
It was a shock. I was with somebody shopping. You know, I received the output from Google, and when I saw the first hypothesis saying you should check the ability of these satellites to get tails, you know, I said to the person, please leave me alone for 1 hour. I need to digest this thing. I wrote to Google saying, you have access to my computer. You know, I'm sure you have a promise. They promised that that was not the case. But the system proposed five hypotheses. The top one was very good. And there was especially one that we never thought about it. And we are now working on that.
It's interesting that Google has named this model CoScient. There's a sense of you and your colleagues working alongside this tool, not that this tool is somehow going to replace you.
That's correct. The feeling we have is that, like a colleague, that you can interact, you can discuss hypotheses, and I think it's a tool. Whatever this system provides, it was based on previous papers or in other viruses, in other satellites, or in other, you know. But I'm pretty sure we'll always room for creativity. For it will be an extremely powerful tool that we need to understand how to use to speed the research and to help us in all research.
Professor José Penades from Imperial College London on the latest example of the power and the positive power of AI. With NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service, I'm Tim Franks. The rift, it seems, is deepening between the American and Ukrainian presidents. Donald Trump has repeated his description of Volodymyr Zelensky as a dictator, someone who could have, but somehow failed to, settle the war with Russia very easily. And indeed, that Ukraine had somehow started the war, which began in 2014 with Russia's first land grab and then was followed 3 years ago, almost to the day, by Russia's full-scale land invasion. President Trump has, it seems, taken particular exception to President Zelensky's comment that Mr. Trump is living in a disinformation space created by Moscow. This was Donald Trump's riposte overnight.
We're successfully negotiating an end to the war with Russia, something I'll admit that only Trump is going to be able to do in the Trump administration. We're going to be able to do it. I think Putin even admitted that. Biden never tried. Europe has failed to bring peace, and Zelensky probably wants to, maybe he wants to keep the gravy train going. I don't know what's the problem, but he hasn't been able. He's very upset that he wasn't invited. He could have come if he wanted to, but that he wasn't invited to Saudi Arabia. But he's been working for 3 years. There's never been even meetings or phone calls to stop this war.
President Trump's repeated characterization of President Zelensky as a dictator came on one of his social media posts, to which today a European Union spokesman, Stefan de Keersmacher, had this to say.
I think we have a fairly straightforward and clear position on this. President Zelensky was legitimately elected in free, fair and democratic elections. Ukraine is a democracy. Putin's Russia is not.
We've been hearing for days now how aghast and depressed many in Ukraine and across Europe are with this turn in events, this reordering of the world order. So what can allies, or at least those countries that are wondering whether they are still allies, do to try to shape events? Next week, Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer is due in the White House, having just phoned Volodymyr Zelensky to offer his backing as a democratically elected leader. Simon Fraser used to be the most senior official of the British Foreign Office, or Foreign Ministry. What would be his advice on how to handle the diplomacy?
We've clearly seen a very serious sort of shift, and rapid shift, in the tone of the relationship between the United States and Europeans over the last week on a number of occasions. So it is a very delicate moment at which Keir Starmer goes to Washington. And I think Europeans feel a bit dismayed and are asking themselves whether they can rely on the United States as an ally. The important thing there is that we have to face up to this change, but we also have to work out ways to maintain engagement with President Trump as the situation evolves. So for Keir Starmer, the challenge is how do you present your own views and maintain your position, but also get some engagement and purchase on American policy so that we can seek to exercise influence in our own and the wider European interest. It's a big challenge.
The point is that when Donald Trump takes against somebody, he really takes against them. And it seems to be that Vladimir Zelensky, by pushing back a bit against the sort of lines that Mr. Trump was coming out with, he has really angered the president. And, you know, similarly, I was reading the Downing Street readout overnight about how Sir Keir Starmer had rung Vladimir Zelensky to offer the UK's backing to him as the democratically elected leader of Ukraine. And I was thinking, you know, my goodness me, I wonder how Donald Trump will see that, whether he will take that as a sort of personal riposte. How do you think he should handle this?
Well, I don't think it's in his the best course of action would be to make this the centre of the discussion with Donald Trump. I mean, Keir Starmer has expressed the British position, and it's a cross-party position, on Zelensky's position and on our support for Ukraine. And I think that's, you know, the sovereign right of the British government to have its view. But rather than get into a difference with President Trump on this, I think the point that should be pursued is to try to understand where he wants to take negotiations with Russia on Ukraine, whether there is a positive outcome that can be achieved, and how we can influence that and contribute to it in a positive way. Now, so far, the debate is very high level, and we don't really, I mean, there's no reason to think that Donald Trump has really thought through in detail the nature of what a ceasefire in Ukraine would consist of. So there's an opportunity to get a more detailed, focused diplomatic discussion on the content. And if we could do that, that might offer a way forward.
Do you see all this as being part of an historic turning point, a recalibration of the US's relationship with Europe in a very significant way, as many people are saying? Or do you think, look, we're 1 month into this administration, let's just, it does feel as if things are moving very fast, but let's just take a breath here?
I think we have to accept that American foreign policy is changing. The priorities of that policy and the way it's conducted, basically on a power-based approach, is changing. And that does affect the relationship with Europe. And it would be unwise of us to bury our heads in the sand and think this is all going to go away. So I think the events of the last week have brought a lot of people to realise that this could be a crystallising moment of change. And we need to prepare for, think through and prepare for that change. So that is the way I think we should approach it. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to have an immediate rupture with America. The relationship with the United States is really important in a whole range of areas. But we do need to think about the implications for Europe of an America which is changing its approach, dealing with Russia differently, dealing potentially with China differently, and has less natural affinity for Europe.
In terms of how much a country such as Britain can make the weather then in that case, and if you're saying it's up to Britain and other European countries to sort of take a lead in what they do, I just wonder how confident you are that they can do that. I mean, specifically when it comes to Ukraine, it would take a heroic effort for Britain to have the sort of defence capabilities which would mean necessarily that they could take a leading role in any future peacekeeping operation if the Russians were to allow them. I mean, both in terms of the strength of the army, but also when you think about the sort of the strength of the economies across Europe, which are looking pretty anemic at the moment.
Yes, but what we're talking about is not just Britain alone, of course. One of the challenges for Britain is that we've got to manage our relationship with the United States, but also our quite complicated relationship with others in Europe since we left the European Union. So getting the balance of those relationships right for the UK is difficult. If the Europeans are going to have to take on greater responsibility for their own defence and security, it's going to have to be a collective effort. And a very big one, which will take time, as you have said, and needs to be done in coordination with others. That is a big challenge. It's going to require a very sustained effort.
The former top official at the British Foreign Office, Simon Fraser. What's the view of all these latest convulsions among ordinary Russians? The Kremlin thought its so-called special military operation in Ukraine would be over in weeks. Instead, Russia's war in Ukraine has dragged on for 3 years, with devastating consequences for Ukraine and heavy losses too for Moscow. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, travelled to the city of Tver, 100 miles from Moscow, to find out how the war has changed the country and whether Russians believe that the new US president will help end the fighting.
Driving into Tver, the first thing I notice are the soldiers, or rather, the pictures of them. They're everywhere, on billboards, the sides of buildings, at bus stops. Portraits with the words Hero of Russia and posters of troops with Kalashnikov rifles encouraging the public to love, defend and have pride in the motherland. In other words, to sign up and go and fight in Ukraine. But the front line is hundreds of miles away, and so even after 3 years of war there are many people here, like Mikhail, a teacher, who find it easy not to think about the fighting.
Just look around. The cars are passing by and all the shops are open and no shells are falling from anywhere. We're not panicking. We're not hearing any sirens wail. We do not like head straight, not to mention run towards any like evacuation points. We're just talking.
Много знакомых ушло туда.
But Anna thinks about the war. She tells me she knows a lot of people who went off to fight and who've never come back. Лариса says she's for the special military operation and would herself volunteer. Clearly, she hasn't so far. She says she wants Ukraine's capitulation. The police turn up and they want an explanation. What is a team from the BBC doing in this city? How long will you be here? We show them our documents. Everything's in order. But they question our driver. They look inside our car. And they ask me to make a statement. I have to note everything down, the officer says. Suddenly, a camera team from state television appears and starts filming us. We were just passing and spotted you, the reporter says. Where have you been so far? What have people been telling you? As you see, we have a free country, freedom of speech. No one gets in your way. Do they? Well, I reply, apart from you and the police next to our car. Eventually, we're allowed to go. This little incident is no real surprise. 3 years of war have fueled suspicion of the West here. But might that change? After all, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin are busy revamping US-Russia relations. So what do people in Tver make of President Trump? Valia tells me that with all the talk of a possible Trump-Putin summit, she hopes for a positive result and that the fighting will end soon. But Mikhail, the teacher, isn't optimistic.
Trump hasn't got any plan, unfortunately. He is an improviser. He doesn't know what he's going to do. My sympathies are with him. But speaking about this particular episode, we are all in the dark, and Trump is in the dark himself.
And yet, by the end of my trip to Tver, I can't help feeling that for much of the time, Russians too are in the dark about the war, about Ukraine, and about the future. People express hopes, yes, but avoid predictions. Is this a sign of fatalism? Partly, but there's also here a deep sense of resignation that the most important questions, like war and peace, will be decided way above the heads of the people.
And that report from our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, from the city of Tver. I notice, according to the Reuters news agency, that the news conference we were expecting between Keith Kellogg, the Trump envoy to Russia and Ukraine and Volodymyr Zelensky has been cancelled at the request of the US team. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. I'm Tim Franks. It is, you will have noticed, the 20th of February, which means it's been exactly 1 month, one very breathless month, since Donald Trump was inaugurated as president for his second term in office. Feels like there's already been major changes, major upheaval. Think domestically in terms of the appointments of some unconventional faces to lead major government agencies, the cost-cutting war on government that's being waged by Elon Musk. And think also in terms of foreign policy, the upending of previous approaches to Ukraine, to Gaza, to the provision of foreign aid. So 1 month on, we wanted to check in with two Republican voters to see how they think the man they picked to lead the country is doing. Jacques Lemoyne runs a golf store in Erie, Pennsylvania, and Kelly Koch is a veteran Republican activist from Des Moines in Iowa. Kelly and Jacques, very good to have you both on the programme. Kelly, if I can begin with you, how do you think he's doing?
It's hard to believe. It's 30 days since the inauguration. We were out in D.C. and witnessed that event, and it's been breakneck speed. Every day we check the radio, the TV, we follow you, United States News, and it is a plethora of activity.
Good activity?
Good activity. We worked so hard coming into November 5th, you know, Iowa, first in the nation caucuses. It started here in Iowa, and Trump won by double digits and then carried on to New Hampshire, South Carolina, and the primaries.
And has it all been good over the last month?
We are so pleased on how everything is going. Today's a big day. We've got the Cash Patel FBI vote coming up. And the big talk here in the Midwest is DOGE. There's no doubt finding the waste and the spending.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is Elon Musk's outfit. Jacques, are you similarly enthusiastic?
I think that Trump has been proactive in what he's doing. He's not doing a knee-jerk reaction like what the prior administration did. I probably agree with about 90% of what's going on with his administration.
May I ask, I don't mean to be sort of unfair, but may I ask about the 10% that you are concerned about?
Well, I think that there are some things that are being overlooked or they don't know enough about that when they go into their cost cutting. They are finding a lot of grafting that happened with the budget and the distribution of money. I mean, they've got they like to have receipts for where things are going. There should be tracking numbers on the checks going out to the different agencies. And there's a lot of things that are kind of ghost.
Yeah, but I mean, on that, Kelly, you are clearly enthusiastic about what Elon Musk is doing. And you know, a lot of people can support the idea that the government should spend money as efficiently as possible. There has been criticism that he's sort of cut first and then ask questions later. I mean, the latest thing I see that's been hit has been a cut to a federal program that supports survivors of the 9/11 attacks. I mean, would you have concerns there?
Well, he did go through, some people refer to it as slash and burn. I like to think of it more of a surgical excision. The DOGE team that he hired, they are unprejudiced. There's no pretense. They are going line by line into each different department looking for waste, fraud, actually, too. And they are finding massive amounts of money. So
It's interesting that you say surgical, because, I mean, he said said on X, his social media platform, that he'd spent the weekend feeding the foreign aid service, USAID, into the wood chipper. That's not surgical.
Well, his words and my word. I'm in healthcare, surgical. I like the words medical. They are using a medical model. They're assessing the sick patient, which is our government and our spending. They're diagnosing the problem, and then they're finding a treatment. And so he did make a comment, as well as President Trump. If there are errors and mistake, they will rectify that. But we are on an unsustainable path with our debt. And the whole country should be grateful that we're finding the solution here.
Jacques, you're I hope you don't mind me saying, an immigrant from France to the United States. One of the big changes, of course, has also been in foreign policy. In particular, we've seen a sort of division of opinion with Europe when it comes to Ukraine and Russia. What do you make of that?
And what point are you looking at over there?
Well, I was just wondering whether you sort of endorse the President Trump's decision to I mean, he's called Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, dictator. He said he is the one who started the war, and he's keen to meet with President Putin. Are these moves that you would endorse?
Well, I think that that's the better route. I think that the prior administration was just prolonging the war. They could have done a lot of things to end it if they were humanitarian, to end the loss of lives. I think that this is a better route than what we had before.
And Kelly, do you feel similarly about this? This it feels like a reordered world that President Trump is presiding over.
President Trump spent a lot of time in Iowa with unprecedented access that we had to him. You get to know his personality. He's a shock and awe type president. And the Ukraine merry-go-round money from the United States to Ukraine, it's unsustainable. So I think he is he got some attention, and now he wants to go to the table. And, you know, Putin is willing, and Zelensky has to come to the table when he's invited. But I do think President Trump set the table straight, and I agree with the gentleman on the other end. The last four years of administration was negligent, and we've got to stop the war. And I think President Trump has the power to do so. Yes.
And Jacques, given that, you know, you're a small businessman in Pennsylvania and the economy is, you know, as ever, it's a huge issue, not just for you, but for all Americans. Just tell me what is going to be the measure of success for you? I mean, we're talking to you 1 month in, but after 4 years, what's going to be the thing that will earn either Mr. Trump your approval or your disapproval?
Well, my biggest thing is that we've got that $36 or $37 trillion of debt. And we're paying out $990 billion a year in interest, and we're not even touching the principal. That's a balance sheet that's terrible for any business. I'm always afraid of this country imploding on itself financially. So if he can, you know, flatten that out or even start to reverse it, I think either one of those moves would be a great success for the country.
Jacques Le Moyne and Kelly Koch, very good to have you both on NewsHour. Thank you both very much for your time. That's it from this edition of the program. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.